This is KUOW's The Record. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. In Seattle's gay community, the attack at Orlando's Pulse nightclub has brought back memories. Memories of a similar attack here at home. New Year's Eve 2013, hundreds of people counted down to midnight inside Neighbors on Capitol Hill. Musab Mizmari snuck into that packed nightclub with a can of gasoline, with the goal of burning the club and killing the people inside. Sean Niddle was there. He was taking video of the party. His husband was handing out the champagne. Niddle told me that when he heard the news about the shooting at Pulse in Orlando, his mind went right back to that night.
Immediately. Not to be sensationalistic or overly dramatic, the truth is it pops right into your mind immediately, and you think to yourself, what if the Musab Mizmari, the gentleman that started the fire at Neighbors, what if instead of a can of gasoline and a lighter, it was a assault rifle and a handgun? So it really harkens, you know, your memory. You go back to like that night and you think, we were lucky and we didn't have anybody that even went to the hospital, versus over 50 people that went to the hospital and, you know, the tremendous amount of life that was taken.
Where were you that New Year's Eve 2013?
My job that night was I was filming the countdown, the drag show for the nightclub. We kind of do these video montages for people. And my husband was at the bottom of the staircase opposite of the one that was set on fire that leads up to the mezzanine. And he was serving champagne. So I had gone over just to check and see how everything was going. And I smelt a very strange smell, like something was burning. And I looked around and I saw the flash of the fire, because he had poured gasoline on carpeted stairs, so it didn't flow down, but it burned very hot and fierce in one area. And I just saw it, and I grabbed my husband by the shoulders and I said, there's a fire, you have to get out. And he turned around and helped usher everybody out. And within 30 seconds to about 45 seconds, everybody was out of the club. It was fantastic. It could not have gone better. It's a matter of seconds. Fire, bullets, knives. It's a matter of seconds. You can see how this could have been a very, very... There were 750 people in the club at the time. That's a tremendous amount of people.
Again, we're talking about the New Year's Eve 2013 fire at the Seattle Club Neighbors. And what did you find out about this man, Musab Mizmari's, his plan, what he was about that night?
Well, once we got everybody out of the building, I went around with the general manager. We were waiting for the police and the fire department, and we walked up the opposite stairs, and I filmed this. We saw a can of gasoline, and it had been placed right at the top of the stairs with the hopes that the fire would have come up and then exploded the can, because people would have been outside on the sidewalk, which would have blown out a window and rained down on people, so further injury. So I said to myself, sort of with a military background, situational awareness and everything, I said, this is not just run-of-the-mill arson. Somebody really planned this. And I expressed my concern that night to the investigators that showed up, and they started to agree, and we said, we've got something else going on here. So once we identified him in video, and detectives went and the public said, okay, we know who this is. People called in, gave a name, gave an address. Then they picked him up. He eventually said that, he had told an informant who had come to the FBI to let them know that he said he wanted to exterminate gay people. And exterminate is a word you use for insects, rodents. So it shows you how sick this man was, how his mental health was so skewed. And also, he had said to somebody at the mosque that he went to that he wanted to that he should get a gun and go back and finish what he started. And luckily, again, that person also went to the feds and said that he had told them this. So we're really thankful for that. We had a Muslim community here that, when they heard these things, said, this, something's not right here, and I'm going to go report this, and they did.
Did that arsonist ever say anything about Islam as having anything to do with his motivation?
Well, he, leading up to all of this, there are a number of incidents and crimes that he had committed, and the police had information about where he was very outspoken about Islam. He did not, and he wanted to exterminate homosexuals because of his religious beliefs. So we were targeted specifically because we were a gay bar, just like how Pulse, they're finding out is the main motivation, from what it looks like, is that it was his hatred for gay people.
Yeah. What is that like for you, that connection then, and here it happens in Florida?
There's so many likenesses between Pulse and Neighbors. If there were a sister club in that city, it would be Pulse. So it was emotional. It has specifically to do with that you're you. You're alive. It's who you love. It's who you are. And it's extra hurtful. It's extra. There's something about it that just cuts you to the core. That because you love who you love, because I married my husband, people want me dead.
We're talking with Sean Niddle about the mass shooting in Orlando, Florida over the weekend and its similarities to the arson at Seattle's Neighbors Club on New Year's Eve 2013. That arsonist got 10 years in jail.
He did, yeah.
What did you think about that sentence?
I testified at the court case, and I said that he was able to plea. Actually, they were going to give him 5 years, and I said absolutely not, and I made my case. The judge threw out the plea and gave him extra 5 years. So we were pleased with that because 5 years for the attempted murder of 750 people, they only charged him with arson, which arson is a crime against a building and not people. We were mortified. Justice was not being served. And so I felt very, very good about the fact that my testimony had impacted the judge in such a way that he said, you know what, he found a way that he was able to throw a plea out and actually give. Since that time, Ms. Murray has done his appeal process and lost every single one of them, and rightfully so. He tried to say that he was blackout drunk, and nobody's buying that. So part of the sentence, the judge has said that he must go through drug and alcohol addiction treatment, and I'm fully for that. We at the nightclub think that it's got to be taken seriously. And we just hope that he gets the help that he needs.
How did you make Neighbors a place people wanted to come again after that 2013 arson?
We thought about it and we said, okay, there are some physical changes that we need to make to the nightclub once we figured out how this gentleman had gotten in. Those physical changes have been done. There are no side doors or anything that someone could slip into. Nowhere that doesn't have a security guard posted. Now, when you come into Neighbors, either through the front lounge on the Broadway side or through the back entrance on the nightclub side, you will encounter two security officers before you even enter the regular club. And they also have doors that can close. So if we have a situation like with Pulse down in Orlando where someone comes in and they start to open fire, it would have to be one security guard, and then those doors can be shut. Within that time, even if it's 10, 5 seconds, you're talking about hundreds of people being able to flee out of another exit. It is the seconds between life and death, and you have to take that seriously. Those are the physical changes that we made.
Was there a time, though, when people didn't want to go there to have fun? They weren't safe? They weren't?
I think maybe within the hours after. But then what we did is we said, okay, somebody came into our environment and they tried to ruin what it means. We're not going to let them do that. So we threw the Neighbors Redux New Year's Eve party the next weekend. The mayor came out. We had a larger crowd than we actually had. We actually did the countdown again. We actually had New Year's Eve, you know, stuff for swag for people and a balloon drop. And it was, you wanted to hug everybody in the room. It was amazing. The outpouring of love. We got messages from other nightclubs and bars, people saying this is terrible that this happened, if we can do anything for you. And people even threw fundraisers for the club to help pay for some of the damage from the fire. So it was really a testament to what the gay community is all about and our allies. Pulse, I believe that community down there, you'll see them bounce back bigger and better than ever. They're down, but they're definitely not, you know, down for the count. It's just not the way that we do business in the gay community.
Unfortunately, Sean, there is a long history of violence against the gay community. How does that affect the reaction to an attack like this?
Since we do learn from our history, we're a community that looks to it for answers. So It affects it in the way that we understand that the counter violence to hate is not more hate. You know, and what I would like to say is that what has changed, you always kind of look at what is the silver lining. And when you have this many people shot and this many people killed, it's very tough to find a silver lining. But what I will say is that 5 years ago, even, I don't think we would have seen the police running towards the violence to help us. I don't think we would have seen 30 hostages rescued, the president condemning this, the attorney general condemning this. This is something that is a game changer for the LGBT community. In the 70s, there in New Orleans, there was a nightclub during the month of June, during Pride Month, called the Upstairs Lounge. Somebody set it on fire. There were bars in the window, and people were trapped and burned to death. It was the largest group of gay people that had been killed at once in the country until yesterday. During that time, the police did not investigate. No one was arrested, and the chatter on the radio was, "Let the fairies burn." So you have that in the 70s, and then you have what happened yesterday. And we have to look at that and be proud and say, look how far we've come. Even though we've lost these people, and we need to mourn that and we need to respect that. The truth is, what's come out of this is a game changer for the gay community moving forward. It's solidarity with the Justice Department, Homeland Security, police. It's a good thing.
Sean Niddle, a journalist in Seattle and a spokesperson for Neighbors Nightclub. He was there at Neighbors on New Year's Eve 2013, right before 2014, when Moussa Masmari tried to burn down that club with hundreds of people inside. Nobody was hurt in that attack. We talked to Niddle on Monday, a day after the attack on Orlando's Pulse nightclub. Speaking of which, today President Obama addressed that shooting in Orlando. The shooter used a semi-automatic rifle, and Obama challenged Congress to reinstate the assault weapons ban that expired in 2004. Most Republicans in Congress and some pro-gun Democrats have opposed reinstating that ban. Hillary Clinton has called for renewing it. Donald Trump is opposed. President Obama also criticized Trump's anti-Muslim rhetoric. Trump had called on Obama to blame the Orlando attack on radical Islam. Obama said that language is a political talking point. It's not a strategy for fighting extremists.
Not once has an advisor of mine said, man, if we really use that phrase, we're going to turn this whole thing around. Not once.
The president also said using the phrase radical Islam would meet the terrorists' goal of portraying the United States as being at war against Islam as a whole.
They want us to validate them by implying that they speak for those billion-plus people, that they speak for Islam. That's their propaganda. That's how they recruit.
Obama also opposed Trump's call to temporarily ban foreign Muslims from entering the United States. And agreeing with Obama on that point is Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan.
I do not think a Muslim ban is in our country's interest. I do not think it is reflective of our principles, not just as a party, but as a country. And I think the smarter way to go in all respects is to have a security test and not a religious test.
And we'll be discussing this in more depth later this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. Stay tuned. This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. How to Make White People Laugh is the new book by comedian Nagin Farsad. She's Iranian-American. She was part of a comedy tour and a documentary called The Muslims Are Coming. Farsad told me she does joke about the presidential campaign, but that's not as easy as it sounds.
Part of the problem for comedians with Donald Trump is that he is so very much his own punchline. Like, you can't really improve on the stuff that he says with a joke. Like, it's because it's already a joke. So in that sense, you know, he's scooping us.
Hard to out-Trump Trump. You have sort of an event you've done, Hug a Muslim. You will hold a sign out. And you had some great reaction to that, actually.
Yeah. Basically, for the film The Muslims Are Coming, we went to Salt Lake City and held up signs that said, Hug a Muslim. And then literally like dozens, you know, probably over 100 Mormons waited in line to hug this Muslim. And if you've never stood, you know, on the streets of Salt Lake City holding a Hug a Muslim sign and then receiving multitudinous hugs from really like warm and delightful Mormons, like, you haven't lived. I highly recommend it. It was one of the more touching things that I think I've ever done.
That's great. You didn't get any, you know, patronizing, I want to convert you vibe or not enough. I mean, mostly it just seemed really happy to you.
Yeah, no, it was super genuine. I didn't get the sense from anyone who hugged me that they wanted to convert me or anything like that. We did get some people, drive-by haters, I like to call them. And these are haters that'll basically, they'll be waiting at a stoplight, the light turns green, and as they drive away, they yell out of their car, go back to your own country, or whatever, like horrible thing they want to yell. So we did get a fair number of those in the course of making that film and doing stuff like Hug a Muslim, but you know, that's fine.
Your book's called How to Make White People Laugh, and so for the record, how do you make white people laugh?
It involves a lot of slipping on banana peels. There's some rubber chickens involved.
We love that.
I mean, so like the little side joke there is that the thing that makes white people laugh is kind of the thing that makes everybody laugh.
Yeah.
And also that it, you know, it's sort of been my mission to figure out what makes white people laugh, because it's been a majority of my audience from the, you know, the beginning of my comedy career. And then the other kind of the ideological underpinning behind why to make white people laugh is that they control a lot of things like government and space and the economy and HBO's Game of Thrones.
Tom Hanks's career.
They've done really well with that. And war. I'll mention that one too. So yeah. Because they control so many things, it's important to keep them laughing and having a good time and lubed up because if they're happy and laughing, they might start fewer wars.
Can I run a theory by you?
Please.
I may be sheltered, but I suspect that most of Trump's voters don't think of themselves as haters, that if they want Muslims or Mexicans or somebody else kept out, it's less a I hate and fear them all thing and more of a I know they're almost all nice, but better safe than sorry. I wish them well in some other country than mine. But I'm curious your take on all of that.
So, I mean, you know, in a taxonomy of haters that I very
which have a chapter.
What I have a chapter of, and it's very scientific and not at all made up by me. Mm-hmm. I call these people swing haters, and because I think what's happening is, especially with this notion of like we need to put up a wall because these Mexicans are coming in taking my job. You know what's not being communicated is like, for example, right now there's net zero immigration right with Mexico, and so there's really not an issue with Mexicans coming in and taking your job. Also, the jobs are taking or not the jobs that you've been trying to get. And it's just a whole, there's like various metrics by which that statement is wrong, but they're not getting that information because swing haters, they hate because of just some rhetoric they hear. It's not, they don't necessarily have the right information, and they can be convinced, I think, to move from hating to not hating with the right information. They're like the sister to the swing voter that way. And so I think these people are salvageable.
Is that part of what you're about? Is salvaging? Or
is converting swing haters. Yeah, that's definitely like one of my big goals.
How do you do that?
You know, for me, it's about comedy, and it's about going out there and trying to use comedy for good and to open up doors as opposed to, you know, like lecturing and after school specialing and those kinds of things. Those things tend to be a little off-putting. And I feel like comedy brings you into a moment of openness. And when you're laughing, you're kind of more willing to hear something.
Can I ask you, do you have a story of swing hater converted?
I don't personally think that one joke I tell or one movie I make is going to convert someone. You know, that's not really how it works.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's
you don't have the antidote?
I don't have the one solution. It's, you know, but I think the way that it does work is that it's a part of a continuum, and that, you know, someone might see something and laugh, and then they'll see another 43 things and laugh. And then at the end of 10 years, they might feel differently. You know, I remember I got an email from someone who fought in Afghanistan, and he went and he did it because he really hated Muslims. And then while he was there, he kind of, despite himself, started to like meet some Muslims that he thought were cool. And he was like, okay, well, this is an exception. And then he came back and he realized that the rhetoric of hating Muslims was just not sitting well with him. And then years later, he started feeling like, oh, I think I was an idiot for thinking that. And then, you know, he was already on the road. He sees my film, The Muslims Are Coming, and then he sends me an email and says, you know, I've been on this road of realizing that, like, hating Muslims is not good and not helpful and not useful. And then I saw your movie and I realized, like, you know, this is it. I don't need to hate Muslims. I don't need to hold on to that anymore.
Yeah, well, we heard this with gay rights, the, you know, when did things change? When people realized they knew someone.
Yeah.
And I feel like in some way, you know, when you make white people laugh, it sounds overly, overly pat, but I think there's something to it, right?
Absolutely. I mean, if, you know, the gay rights movement is such a great example, because if we think that Ellen had nothing to do with, you know, gay rights, or Will and Grace had nothing to do with gay rights, if we thought that these people being in our living rooms, you know, had nothing to do with our changing attitude towards gay rights, where we can say now that, you know, it's legal for them to marry, we'd be wrong. I mean, culture had so much to do with that, because the more, you know, people you meet, the harder it is for you to hate them.
Nagin Farsad is the author of How to Make White People Laugh. Her new feature film, Third Street Blackout, comes out July 5th, available on your basic iTunes and Amazon and cable on demand and stuff. And we're tweeting out a link to the trailer right now on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. We are at KUOW. This is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. Machines that can think are going to change your life. In his new book, Inevitable, former Wired magazine editor Kevin Kelly writes, it's hard to imagine anything that will change everything as much as cheap, powerful, ubiquitous artificial intelligence. Kelly says we tend to think of AI as something far off in the future, but it's being used invisibly right now in the airplanes you fly on, the brakes in your car. Kevin Kelly told KUOW's Ross Reynolds how artificial intelligence will become as commonplace as electricity.
This AI, this artificial smartness, is not human-like. And that's part of its benefit, is that it is often much more narrow in its achievements, and it can do things that we can't do. The reason why we want it to drive our auto-driven cars is because it doesn't drive like us. It's not distracted. It's not thinking about whether it left the stove on. It's just going to drive. And so we're making many different types of thinking, many different types of AI. And these different kinds of AI are going to become a commodity that we are delivered on the cloud, much in the same way that we delivered artificial power, electricity, on the grid. And that you'll be able to actually today, right now Google's selling it, you can buy as much AI as you want to apply to whatever problem you have, just like you can buy as much artificial power as you want to electrify your thing. So the way I would say it is that everything that we've electrified on through a grid, we're now going to cognify through a grid, and it becomes a commodity. So that means, in the same way that we had this huge industrial revolution where we took this artificial power so that you didn't have to make things with human muscle or animal muscle, you could use 250 horses to power your car down the road. Now we're going to have 250 minds in addition to the 250 horses to make the auto-driven car. We can take these artificial minds and apply it to everything that we already have automated. So the formula that I like to suggest to people is the next 5 years is take something and make it smarter and cognify it. So here's an idea. Let's take taxis and we'll make them smarter. That's called Uber. That's the kind of thing that we're going to be doing.
It's pitched as a convenience. It'll allow you to live your life more easily. But at the same time, the companies that control this technology are just a few oligarchy of companies. How do we know that this will not eventually turn into something more for their benefit than for our benefit?
Well, yes. Is Google more for Google's benefit than our benefit? I mean, the answer so far because they are companies and they have to survive, is unless they can satisfy both of them, they're not going to last for very long. So I think that we are sharing benefits, but in the course they're benefiting as well. The thing about these natural monopolies, whenever you have networks, you have network effects, which means that the natural monopolies tend to aggregate very big. So the biggest get bigger and bigger, and the bigger they get, the better they get, and the better they get, the bigger they get. Those are natural monopolies. But the thing about the natural monopolies is they swell up very fast, but they also collapse just as fast. So where is Microsoft as a monopoly? Everybody was worried about that 2 decades ago. They were displaced by Google. Everyone's worried about Google, but Google is at its peak right now. It's likely that there will be an AI natural monopoly. It's unlikely to be Google or anything exists right now, although they are the big players. History of technology would suggest it's going to be a disruptive force from the outside. But they will also not last very long because somebody will invent an AI that's 10 times better, and everybody will immediately move over to that one.
But if you get the best AI, it's going to invent itself, will invent the next. Well, if it's owned by one company, there you go.
As a matter of fact, right now, Facebook is using its AI to develop better AI algorithms right now today.
Success in that, and who's going to catch up with Facebook?
Well, that's one way to do it, but it's not the only way. Because they're using the same algorithm to improve the versions of it. But what if somebody in London or China comes up with a completely radical idea? So let me give you one example. The way that all the AIs work today is they work on huge data sets. That's why all the big AI players are Google and Amazon and Microsoft and Baidu, because they have the big data. Because it takes millions of examples to train them. A little baby, a human baby, to learn the difference between a cat and dog doesn't take a million examples. It takes only 12. What if somebody outside of them learns how to figure out how to train the AI in a few data sets? They no longer need the big data. They can be a young startup and they can disrupt the whole place.
Artificial intelligence gets better because it learns from our intelligence.
Yes.
And it takes information from us. But we know that our intelligence is highly imperfect. There are many things in our thought patterns that are just wrong. We're not very good at estimating economic reality.
Or probabilities.
Or probabilities. Faced with facts which dispute core beliefs, we reject them, even if they're factual. So how do we know that AI isn't going to adopt some of our mental quirks at the same time as it's adopting to us?
It certainly, that is a possibility. But another possibility is it actually learns to think in some ways more logical than us. We also, it's possible for us to teach to be more ethical than us, because what all you said about our own intelligence is true about our ethics, which are very inconsistent, not very deep. Today, actually, there is AIs who are used in making mathematical proofs. And the curious thing about these very, very complicated mathematical proofs is that there is no human who understands them. You can look inside it and you just can't make any sense. The mathematicians can't make any sense of it. But he says, this AI that says this is true. Do we want to believe it or not? And we're going to have more occasions like that where a decision of the AI was not going to be transparent to us.
Kevin Kelly is telling us about one of the technological trends which is going to change the world from his book called The Inevitable. As artificial intelligence becomes more and more ingrained, it relies on a network. It also relies on a power network. As we become more dependent on these things that rely on networks, could the downfall of the electric grid even temporarily prove to be catastrophic?
Catastrophic is a very strong word. It could certainly be a disaster, a natural disaster in a sense. If the internet went down in a very large area for more than 24 hours, yes, we would feel it. Everything would be impacted. It would be like having an earthquake or beyond. What we wanted to do is make sure that doesn't happen, or it doesn't happen very often. And in a curious way, we can actually have AI helping us prevent that from happening by monitoring all the kinds of things that would bring it down. And I think that's actually what civilization is that we have multiple layers and layers and layers to try and make sure that this very complex system stays robust. The answer is not to simplify it. That doesn't work. The answer is to add other layers, which is how your body works. Your body has multiple ways to prevent you from dying.
How about jobs in the future where many things are able to be done by intelligent machines? In the past, we've always seen new jobs developing, but we're talking really about a large factor here of jobs going away. Journalist jobs. There are already AIs that will write short sports stories. Give them the stats and they'll write it up in perfectly good language. Short business stories can be written up by computers. Are we at a point where so many jobs are going away that people won't have productive work to do?
Most of the jobs that are going to AI and robots and will go to them in the future are tasks that we can define in terms of efficiency or productivity. In other words, it's something that there's a measurement and you're working towards it and you're trying to make it more efficient. And those are all the kinds of things that can go to AI and robots, including not just manual labor, but as you said, white-collar work, doing a mortgages. And that leaves humans to do the kinds of jobs which AI, for a long time, we're not going to be very good at, which is wasting time, which is basically things that are inefficient. Some of the best things we do are inefficient, like science. Science, by definition, you've got to make mistakes. You have to have failure. If you're never making any mistakes in doing science, you're not learning anything. So it is inherently inefficient. Innovation is inherently inefficient because you're going to try stuff that doesn't work. You're making prototypes. These are all wastes of time in a kind of a large sense, but they're absolutely necessary to explore. So any kind of exploration is inherently inefficient, not good for robots and AI. And that is also true for human experiences. Interpersonal relationships are terribly inefficient. Chit-chat. That's not accomplishing anything. And so all these kinds of things that the humans are really good at are things that machines are not very good at all. These are also things that we're going to pay a lot of money for. These are the only kinds of things right now that are increasing in prices. Everything else that we can make in terms of productivity is on a long-term trend downward. And so therefore, these are not just jobs that are cerebral or symbol processing. Sitting by someone on the bedside when they're sick is not something you need a PhD to do. You just need to be human to do that. And those are the things that we're actually paying a lot of money for.
Talking there with KUOW's Ross Reynolds, that's former Wired magazine editor Kevin Kelly, who writes about the massive potential of artificial intelligence to change all of our lives. Again, his new book is called Inevitable. Speaking of the big tech companies, as they were, Amazon is happy today. Netflix is happy. Google, Facebook, they all lobbied the federal government to keep something called net neutrality, which means internet providers have to treat all web traffic neutrally, equally. Those internet providers like Comcast and Verizon, they can't make the big content providers like Amazon pay extra to keep their data-heavy videos and stuff flowing fast to your screen. Well, today, the Amazons and Netflixes won a big round when a federal appeals court upheld the government's net neutrality rules. The court found that broadband internet is not just a fun service that you buy, it is now a kind of utility. So the federal government can enforce a net neutral playing field. This is something we're going to take a deeper look at later this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. And also, speaking of computers, the Democratic National Committee's computer networks have been breached by Russian hackers who stole opposition research on Donald Trump. Again, more on this during KUOW's All Things Considered this afternoon. You're with KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. It was 2007 when a parent complained to school administrators in Maine that a student named Nicole Maines was being allowed to use the girls' restroom. Maines was a transgender girl. Author Amy Ellis Nutt tells her story in the book Becoming Nicole.
It was a young boy in the fifth grade who, at the instigation of his guardian, his grandfather, followed Nicole into the girls' room that she had been using always without incident, and said, well, you're really a boy, and if you can be in here, then I can be in here too.
Administrators banned Nicole from using the girls' bathroom. In 2014, she and her family won a discrimination lawsuit against the school in the Maine Supreme Court. Amy Ellis Nutt told me that this case and Nicole's story stand at the beginning of this national debate we're having, including in Washington State, about transgender rights.
It was the first case to be won, first case brought against a school system by a student in which transgender student won the right to use the restroom of her gender identity. So it kind of set the table for this discussion.
Why do you think this is so full of grappling, so difficult?
You know, honestly, I think it's so difficult because it is foreign to most people. But I think the misconceptions and the myths around what transgender people, who they are and what it means to have a different gender identity than the body you were born into, it causes people to feel, you know, uncomfortable. And it's difficult to wrap their heads around. I mean, one of the most poignant things about Nicole as she was growing up and identifying always from the age of two as female, and obviously well before she transitioned, before college, surgically transitioned, she would take showers in the dark. Transgender people don't want to be reminded of the anatomy that doesn't match who they feel and believe they are. So the last thing that a transgender person wants anyone to see in a public bathroom or any place else is a part of their anatomy that is foreign to them.
I want to talk about some of the public's discomfort with this. You know, at a public bathroom here in Seattle, a place called Green Lake, a man went into the women's room saying, "Hey, I identify as a woman today." And the question was, is this the beginning of a serious ongoing backlash against transgender rights?
You know, this is an issue that's misplaced. And, you know, it's a matter of someone who identifies and is and believes and acts and dresses as the gender they believe themselves to be should be allowed to use the restroom of their choice. And they do all the time without incident. The incidents are being caused by people who want to make it an issue who are not transgender. It's society that favors conformity, but it's nature that favors diversity. And that when we begin and when we're able to look at transgender as not an aberration but a variation, then I think, you know, we're more than halfway towards accepting.
And how problematic do you think that kind of backlash is? Do you think this is something that was a one-off and we'll virtually never hear it again? Or do you think there's actually going to be a problem, as those opponents seem to want to point out, that there's a problem here? Hey, anybody can go into any place.
You know, but it's just not the case. The way the laws are set up, it's if you are a transgender person, if you identify, it's not a matter of, oh, today I'm going to identify as black or as Native American or, you know, as a man or as a woman. It doesn't work that way, obviously. And I do think whether this is a one-off or two or a three-off, I do think that these will be the minority because generally in life, the way this has worked is it has not been a problem. And I think the less we draw attention to it, then I think the more acceptable it will be to people when they realize there's nothing to be afraid of. There are no incidents of a transgender person attacking someone in a bathroom. It just hasn't happened. And therefore, whatever safety concerns are raised are, frankly, unfounded.
What do you think then is happening to our cultural idea of gender? What do you imagine gender is going to mean to Americans in, I don't know, a generation, 50 years? What do you see?
Look, there are many, many variations of gender that we've discovered. Not everyone is 100% male or 100% female. We are all variations on the average, both in our physique, our sexual organs, and in our, frankly, a lot of times in our gender identity. We're brought up with these stereotypes that really end up being stereotypes. It's easier to be able to categorize people, but frankly, it diminishes who we really are. So as our understanding of who we are expands, we need to expand and make room in our language and frankly, in our understanding of one another. And that's not easy. And it does mean, you know, grappling, you know, with what male and female means. It doesn't mean, you know, anybody can be anybody who they are, but we are all different. There are many variations and gradations of being human. It is a human continuum. And I think the more we're able to sort of understand the subtleties of that, I think the better we are as individuals and as a society.
You can see the pull, the allure of keeping things simple, even in your story of Nicole Maines, her mom, whose daughter is a transgender girl, still says things like, yeah, Nicole, even from the beginning, she wanted to wear girls' clothes. I mean, even her mom still has in her mind, there's girls' clothes and there's boys' clothes.
Right. But that's right. And, you know, look, we do know that there are, in general, differences between men and women. That's clear. But it's not a matter of greater or better or smarter or more gifted. It's a matter of differences. And the differences end up actually being, you know, fairly minute.
Parents of transgender kids will tell you, your child is not like you expected. Well, isn't that called parenthood?
Yeah. But, you know, we all have expectations. We have expectations all of our lives as a son or as a daughter, as a mother, as a father. And I think what was interesting about the Maines family was, you know, Wayne grew up in a small town, very close-knit family. And he had a sense of what his expectations of having a family were based on his experience. Kelly grew up in the Midwest. She was given up for adoption by her birth mother. She left home at 16. You know, she had a much more chaotic background. And to that extent, she wasn't laden with the expectations of what a perfect family looked like. And I think it behooved her and Nicole because she was basically open to figuring out what her child needed, not what she needed or what she wanted her child to be, but what was her child telling her. And, you know, she began where a lot of us begin in this day and age. She began by Googling boys who like girls' toys. And that led her on an odyssey of discovering who her child was and how she could best help her.
So, Amy Ellis Nutt, do you have a sense that this American transgender debate right now, it's centering around bathrooms and locker rooms. Do you have a sense that this debate will dwindle as a debate, or that we're just we're digging into closely held values that are going to continue to be a sore spot in this country?
You know, I don't really think it's about values, and that's why I don't think that this debate, this controversy, is long-lasting. At least I hope it's not. I think in some way it's been focused on bathrooms because, again, that's sort of easy to get our minds around. You have a boys' room and you have a girls' room, and therefore we think everything should be neat and easy. In fact, it's been okay all along. This is essentially a kind of made-up controversy based on people trying to understand or not understand or not grapple with what it means for a person who is born into a certain anatomy to identify as the opposite gender. Look, in my lifetime, I didn't think we'd get to gay marriage. I think the extent to which transgender people are being discussed and interviewed and are appearing more on TV and on the covers of magazines and in books like Becoming Nicole, I believe that it's all a process of familiarizing and educating. And I would challenge anyone who talked with Kelly and Wayne or talked to Nicole or talked to Jonas to think other than that they're a pretty ordinary family, a mother, a father, a son, and a daughter. And I think that that's the direction we're going. At least I hope so.
Amy Ellis Nutt is the author of Becoming Nicole, The Transformation of an American Family. Here in Washington, there is a proposed state initiative that would change the state's discrimination law so that bathrooms and locker rooms, public or private, could be restricted to so-called biologically male or female people. This is Initiative 1515, and the signature gathering is underway. You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Bill Radke.